Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
This episode contains adult language and descriptions of violence. Please use discretion.
I used to say about Nub City is if they would do this to themselves, think about what they would do to you. That was going to be my tagline for the movie. If they would do this to themselves, just think about what they would do to you.
Errol Morris is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker and writer. He's perhaps best known for his 1988 documentary, The Thin Blue Line, about a wrongful conviction in a murder case. He's also made movies about a pet cemetery, a lion tamer, and the U.S. government's actions in the Vietnam War. But there's one movie he's always wanted to make, that he tried to make early in his career, but never figured out how.
I remember one weekend, I'm reading the New York Times Magazine, and there's an article about an insurance investigator named John Healy. And he's talking about his crimes, working as an investigator. It's a half a paragraph in the article. He mentions the worst case he's ever been involved in. Of course, this immediately gets my attention. The worst case? Oh, boy. Nub City, the town in the swamp in Florida, where there's been this extraordinary history of insurance crime. What kind of crime? Self-mutilation. So the way in which insurance policies are written, you can take out a policy if you're going on a hunting trip. Oh, say you're going to be gone for a week, 10 days, whatever, and you want some protection against the possibility of a hunting accident, God forbid. You take out a policy that has an accidental dismemberment clause. But, you know, you can take out just so much insurance on a hunting trip. Much better. Life insurance. Most life insurance has a provision, an accidental dismemberment provision, that if you lose both arms or both legs or an arm and a leg, you get the full gajinkus, the whole life insurance policy. It also works if you put out both eyes or put an auger through both ears, but the preferred method was an arm and a leg on opposite sides of the body so you could use a crutch. And there was a whole mess of those guys. Nub City. The Nub Club.
Is it really called the Nub Club?
Well, not by them, but by the insurance companies, it's called the Nub Club, yes. Yeah.
Errol Morris went to visit insurance investigator John Healy.
And I tell him, you know, this Nub City thing, I'm kind of excited about this story. He said, you're not going to go down there. That place is dangerous. They'll kill you. Don't even think about it. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And I went down there. against good advice. And I don't know what I was thinking.
I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal. When Errol Morris first visited the place that insurance investigator John Healy called Nub City, actually a town called Vernon, Florida, 90 miles west of Tallahassee, it had a population of less than 1,000 people. This was in the 1970s. Vernon was a rural town, and John Healy wrote that there was little or no work there, so most of the people who did work had to drive 30 or 40 miles to other bigger towns nearby. In the first part of the 20th century, the steamboat had stopped coming through and the mill shut down. The county seat was moved from Vernon to a nearby town. By 1960, more than half of the population of Vernon received welfare aid. According to John Healy, the first dismemberment occurred sometime in the 1950s when a man shot his hand off and collected $1,500 on a small policy. After that, he said, quote, word spread like wildfire throughout the community. By the early 1960s, insurance experts estimated that more than two-thirds of all loss of limb accident claims in the United States came from Vernon, Florida, and the panhandle area around it. An editor at the local paper wrote, you have to realize there was a time when these people ate possums because there was nothing else to eat. So you had to go out and run down a possum, plug him to death, and eat him. What do you need your left foot for if you can cut it off, get $200,000, and not have to worry about chasing possums anymore? There were a number of investigations, but according to the Tampa Bay Times in 2007, not a single insurance claimant was ever convicted of fraud. As one insurance official put it, it was hard to make a jury believe a man would shoot off his foot.
I was a moron. Because what do you think you're going to do, Mr. Morris? You're going to go around to people's houses and ask them about how they committed insurance fraud? These people have committed horrible crimes. They've mutilated themselves. What are you going to ask them? What are they going to say to you? What are your crazy expectations of what is going to transpire here? And I learned pretty quickly this was not a good way to go. I meet the sheriff of Washington County. Nub City is in Washington County. I'm looking at the criminal docket. I want to know what kind of crimes do they have down here? And I can't really find any murders. None. So I asked the sheriff, I said, you know, there don't seem to be any murders down here in Washington County. And he looks at me like, I'm crazy. He says, down here, we don't have murders. We just have disappearances. And he gives me this odd look. And I thought to myself, you know, I actually don't want to be a disappearance down here. But notwithstanding, I moved down there. I went to an insurance agent, and he tried to construct with me all of the incidences of, you know, insurance claims, accidents. And with his help, I was able to piece together a list of about 30 of these cases.
The insurance agent helping Errol Morris, L.W. Burdishaw, told the Tampa Bay Times about one man who collected payments from 11 different insurance companies. Burdishaw himself had sold the man a 10-day policy to cover a hunting trip, and on the very first day out, the man claimed his friend accidentally shot him in the foot. Burdishaw remembered being at dinner at his daughter's house when he got the call about the shooting. He says he didn't even need to be told what happened. He knew right away that the man had been shot in his left foot. When his daughter asked him how he knew, he said, because that son of a bitch is going to drive a Cadillac with his right foot. He described another payout to a different man who lost a foot. That man claimed that he accidentally shot himself when he thought he saw a squirrel on the ground. His insurance policy was less than 12 hours old. There is also a man who sawed off his left hand at work, a man who shot off his foot protecting his chickens at night, a man who shot off his hand while trying to shoot a hawk, and a man who somehow managed to lose a hand and a foot in an accident involving a rifle and a tractor. Birdershaw had sold policies to all of them. He wasn't the only insurance agent trying to make sense of this increase in accident claims. Specifically, why more and more people in Florida were losing their hands and feet. One insurance agent, Murray Armstrong of Liberty National, told newspapers about a farmer who lost his left foot to a shotgun blast. This particular farmer had taken out so much insurance that his insurance bills exceeded his income. Dismemberment was a feature of nearly all of the farmer's policies. When the accident occurred, a tourniquet was found in the farmer's pocket. He claimed that he carried a tourniquet, quote, in case of snake bite. He also happened to be driving his wife's automatic transmission car around the farm the day the accident happened. He usually drove a pickup truck. The insurance agent pointed out that it seemed pretty convenient that he happened to be driving a car with automatic transmission, so he wouldn't have to use his left foot to work the clutch. According to the insurance agent, the farmer's coverage with around 38 companies exceeded $2 million. But in the end, he agreed to settle for about half. An attorney with Liberty National described another case where three men in Northwest Florida each lost a hand or a foot in accidents involving the same saw. Errol Morse wanted to find out what was going on. But when he got to Vernon, Florida, hoping to find some answers and make a documentary, the only people open to talking to him were insurance agents. He was only able to speak with a few residents. He says that some people in Vernon didn't appreciate him asking questions. One night at a bar, a man put his cigarette out on Errol Morris's lapel. He says another man tried to run over his cinematographer with a truck. He says the only time he was ever beaten up in his life was in Vernon.
So that first trip was unsuccessful, and I don't know what I would do today, but if the idea was that I was going to go with a film crew around to these various houses and talk to these people, it was pretty clear pretty quickly that that was not going to work out very well.
Eventually, so many people in and around Vernon were filing insurance claims that insurance companies reportedly stopped selling to them. According to the Tampa Bay Times, some insurance companies implemented a rule that they would not pay if the policyholder lost a hand or a foot within a year of signing the policy. The Florida legislature later outlawed these kinds of exclusion clauses. As insurance investigators tried to crack down, some people reported they couldn't get insurance of any kind. In 1972, one woman told the Tampa Bay Times that when she tried to insure her home after her husband died, she was told, quote, it couldn't be done, not in this town. That same year, insurance investigator John Healy told the New York Times, we pretty well stopped this thing. Errol Morris never did get to make a movie about the alleged insurance fraud, but he did go back to Vernon, Florida, to make a completely different documentary. The movie doesn't exactly tell a story. It's just people of Vernon talking. A couple who believes some sand they've collected in a jar is growing. A preacher who's obsessed with the word therefore. And the only police officer in town who waits in a squad car for something to happen.
I have different areas I like to sit around and wait. I sit here a lot of time. Since this car was sitting around so much, while the people, they don't know for sure if we have a police officer on duty here or not. So I can sit here and catch a lot of them as they come across the bridge or come down through town. like his tanker. He sounds like he's getting on it now.
Errol Morris called the movie Vernon, Florida, and there's no mention of any accidents or insurance fraud. Many residents of Vernon were not happy about the movie. In August of 1982, Vernon City Councilwoman Narvel Armstrong was quoted in the Tampa Bay Times as saying that Errol Morris came here to do one thing, run down the town. And when he found he couldn't do what he came here to do, he made Vernon look bad, picked on the eccentric things. Support for Criminal comes from Ritual. Ritual's Essential for Women is a multivitamin with an ingredients label you can trust. Ritual uses a delayed-release design in their capsules. That means your body absorbs what it needs when it needs it. That also makes it easy on your stomach, and you don't even need to take it with food. And while some vitamins smell terrible, Ritual puts a peppermint oil-infused tab in each bottle that keeps each bottle smelling fresh. Ritual's Essential for Women works to support your brain, bones, and red blood cells, and it's USP verified, meaning the ingredients label matches exactly what's inside, so you know what you're putting in your body. I've been taking Ritual every day for a few months now. My favorite things about it are that it doesn't smell or taste like other vitamins, and that it has omega-3 DHA and vitamin D3. Ritual's Essential for Women 18+ is a multivitamin you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/criminal. Start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18+ to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/criminal for 25% off.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
After the film Vernon, Florida was released in 1981, Errol Morris had trouble getting financing for other film projects, so he became a private detective. He once said being a private detective is having, quote, the ability to sit and talk to people and have people, even more importantly, talk to you. It comes down to an interest in finding out things. So I learned quickly that what I did as a filmmaker was not so different from what I was doing as a private investigator.
I remember I had one job where I had to pose as a filmmaker in order to get information. And I thought, this is really fucked up. I am a filmmaker. I'm an out-of-work filmmaker. I'm not making a film as we speak right now. But I'm a filmmaker. I've made a couple of films. People actually even thought they might be pretty good. But I couldn't get work as a filmmaker, so I'm working as a private detective, posing as a filmmaker.
Was it exciting work?
Yeah. I like being a detective.
Were you good at it?
I think I am very good at it. I mean, self-serving of me to say so. But yeah, I think I'm good at it. I made this movie, The Thin Blue Line, a movie that I'm still very, very proud of. And that was an investigation, and unusual in all of these movies that are made of true crime stories, I, through some strange set of circumstances, uncovered a terrible miscarriage of justice in Texas. You don't get to do that every day. I always think that the best ways into a story are unexpected ways into a story. I've never had this desire to go through the front door, but to go through a side door, climb through a window, maybe if necessary, like Santa Claus, go down the chimney. I had come to Texas to interview a Dallas psychiatrist, Dr. James Gregson, who testified at capital murder trials and played a very, very critical, crucial role in sentencing people to death.
James Gregson was sometimes called Dr. Death. He testified in more than 100 capital cases in Texas, almost always for the prosecution.
And so at his behest, I went down to a number of Texas prisons and interviewed people who had been sentenced to death. Some of them had been commuted off of death row, but all of them at one time or another had been sentenced to death in Texas, in part because of the testimony that Dr. Gregson had offered at their capital murder trials. And that was the beginning of it. And quite simply, I had no reason to believe that any of them were innocent. That was not why I was talking to them. That was not why I was there. I was not there to uncover miscarriages of justice or to rebalance the scales of justice in some way. But the Adams case, which became the Thin Blue Line, grabbed a hold of me.
The Thin Blue Line tells the story of a man on death row named Randall Adams, who was convicted of killing a Dallas, Texas police officer in 1976. Adams always maintained his innocence. In the film, Errol Morris interviews almost everyone involved in the case. The judge, the detectives, witnesses. He re-examines the evidence and looks at inconsistencies.
I went to Austin because every single murder trial, capital murder trial, is automatically appealed under Texas statutes to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and you go to their library, go down to the basement, you can get every single transcript for every murder trial. You can sit down there and read to your heart's content, which is what I did. And in reading the trial of Randall Adams, now this is a guy I had spoken to without a camera, I had met him. A preliminary meeting. I couldn't understand his story. He was one of those people. Not everybody said this, but a number of people did say this. I didn't do it. I'm innocent. This is terrible. Adams kept talking about the kid. I needed to talk to the kid, the kid. And I didn't understand the case. I go to Austin. I start reading the transcript of his trial. And I thought, oh, this doesn't quite add up, does it? I love film noir. The film noir that I particularly love, Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum. And this line kept coming back to me again and again and again. I don't quite quote it accurately, but it's the essence of it. Robert Mitchum is in the back of a taxi cab. He's talking to the taxi driver. And he says, I could see the frame, but I couldn't see the picture. And that was very much my experience of the Randall Adams case. I had the strong feeling that he had been framed. But the details of exactly what had happened and how it had happened and what it meant, I did not know and wouldn't know until I spent over a year and a half investigating.
Had you talked to other people in prison who were proclaiming their innocence, but you could kind of tell were really actually guilty? And was there anything different in the way that Randall Adams was asserting his innocence, in the way that he was telling you, that made you think, maybe this guy really is innocent?
In retrospect, yes, but how you view what someone says is so dependent on what you think about what they have done and who they are. When someone tells you they're innocent, who's been on death row, the inclination is to think, maybe not. I knew that there was some missing piece in this story. it's interesting in retrospect, because a lot of this is in retrospect. Adams had a very strange way. This is the guy who was convicted of a murder that he didn't commit, who wasn't there, who was home in bed. He had a way of talking. It's really crazy way of talking. A kind of sing-song way of talking, where he would say things almost as if he had gone through some kind of performance piece, this endless recitation that he had gone through many, many, many times, but he knew no one was going to believe him. But yet he did it anyway. Now I look back on it, I think you told a story as a story that was true, but you knew while telling the story I was never going to believe that that was the case. There's something so unbelievably sad about that.
Here's Randall Adams speaking with Errol Morris in the film.
His whole story from the start was 2 hours late. I met this kid at around 10 o'clock in the morning. He says we met at noon. I say we were at the Bronco Bowl at 2 or 3 o'clock. He says it was 5 or 6 o'clock. Everything that we did coincide with, he was 2 hours late. 2 hours later, 2 hours into the night. His testimony is that as we were getting off the freeway on Inwood Avenue, he stated that I'm driving the car, that we're pulled over. He gets scared and he slumps down in the seat of the car. That as the officer walks up and shines his flashlight, and I roll down my window, I pull the pistol out and blow this man away. His testimony is, when I finally do drive to the motel, I get out, I tell him, don't worry about it, forget this ever happened. Now that's crazy. That's crazy.
This person who Randall Adams said was 2 hours late about everything, who testified against Randall Adams in the trial, was named David Harris. David Harris had testified that he had seen Randall Adams shoot the police officer several times. Randall Adams begged Errol Morris to go find him and talk to him.
And I thought, what the hell? I'm going to try to find this kid. He had come from a small town in East Texas, Vidor. And I found David Harris's parole officer. It turns out that since these murders, he had been in prison for other crimes. He had just been released from San Quentin and was living with his family back in East Texas. And I asked the parole officer, would you mind giving me his phone number? I'd love to talk to this guy. And she said, no, I can't do that. Says, but you give me your phone number, and if he wants to talk to you, he'll call you. I thought, oh, okay. I gave her my phone number. I thought I'd never, ever, ever hear from this person. But within, I would say, 5 minutes, he called me. Called me and invited me to come out to Vidor. Meet him at a bar in the swamp outside of Vidor.
Vidor, Texas was once known as a KKK stronghold and as a sundown town where black people were threatened with violence for being outside after dark.
It was a scary place. I mean, a really scary place. And David Harris was still like a kid, covered with tattoos. And clearly he was meeting me because he wanted information from me. He thought, oh, Randall Adams has probably been executed. And he was surprised, I told him, you know, the guy still very much alive. And so then David Harris kept asking me, well, what does he have to say about me? And I try to be diplomatic. I say, well, you know, he's upset about a number of things. In fact, you fingered him for a capital murder. And we sat in this bar drinking. And at the end of our meeting, he kept saying to me, I want you to be really careful driving home. I was driving back to Huntsville from Vidor, Texas. I want you to be really careful. And I've often thought, if someone tells you to be really, really careful driving home once, they probably mean that they want you to be really careful driving home. If they say it twice, that's something different. And if they say it three times, it's a threat. And I remember being freaked out. And at first I thought he was following me. I thought these headlights. I was completely spooked. And then the headlights drifted away. I thought, he's gone. And I stopped at a gas station and I called my wife in New York and I said to her, I just met David Harris and I think he might be the real killer. And my wife started screaming at me. You idiot! So that's at the beginning of The Thin Blue Line, if you like.
The Thin Blue Line was released in 1988. The final scene is a recording of David Harris telling Errol Morris that he's sure that Randall Adams is innocent of the murder. Here's part of that recording. The first voice you hear is Errol Morris.
Well, what do you think about whether or not he's innocent?
I'm sure he is.
How can you be sure?
Because I'm the one that knows.
Were you surprised that the police blamed him?
They didn't blame him. I did.
After the film was released, there was a motion for a new trial for Randall Adams. David Harris recanted his original testimony and said, I realize I've been responsible for a great injustice. David Harris was never charged with the murder of the police officer. He was in prison for another murder when the film was released, and he was executed in 2004. The evidence presented in The Thin Blue Line is credited with helping to exonerate Randall Adams. He was released from prison in 1989. The Museum of Modern Art describes The Thin Blue Line as, quote, arguably one of the most influential films of the last 50 years and a seminal true crime document.
Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of two, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to help keep you all on the same page from start to finish. That way, every one of your teams, from engineering and IT to marketing, HR and legal, can stay connected and move together as one towards shared company-wide goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's A-T-L-A-S-S-I-A-N.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
How did you learn to investigate? How did you...
I don't know if you learn that kind of thing. Do you? It's fueled by some kind of strange curiosity, some kind of strange desire to find out more, to learn something that you don't know. It's like interviewing people. It's not even about what you want to know. It's wanting to know something you don't know. I often say about interviews, to the extent I know what someone is going to say in an interview, why bother? Why even do the interview? Why talk to anybody? Unless the nature of the enterprise is just a recitation of stuff that you already expected to hear or wanted to hear or thought you were going to hear. What I love in the end about interviewing people, whether it's in the course of writing a book or making a movie, is hearing something truly extraordinary, something that you could never even have made up on your own.
Like what? Can you remember a couple that...
I suppose the very beginnings of this were interviews that I did when I was a graduate student at Berkeley. In the Santa Cruz area, there were a series of serial killers, mass murderers, however you want to describe them. This is in the 70s, that fascinated me. And that was the beginning of it. I started to interview killers. I started to interview killers and their families, killers and their psychiatrists. By the way, if you ask me why I was doing this stuff, I don't know. My mother, who never really liked my talking to mass murderers, my mother had this amazing euphemistic style, said to me, "You know, Errol, I wish you would spend more time with people your own age." And I said, "But Mom, the mass murderers are my own age." Herbie Mullen. Herbie had just been convicted of 10 counts of murder.
In August 1973, 26-year-old Herbert Mullen was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder and 8 counts of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison.
And I went to visit his father. This is right after the sentencing. Near the end of the interview, he said, "Are you going to see Herbie? You going to visit Herbie?" I said, "Yes, I probably am." He said, "Well, there's something I'd like you to tell Herbie for me. Tell him he better watch out or he's going to be in big trouble." I said, "Okay. Yeah. I'll tell him." I suppose, in parentheses, "Sir, Herbie is already..."
He's there.
"...in big trouble. No need to tell him that." And I didn't.
You interviewed...
I'll give you another story as long as we're in the story mode. I had been an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And no one who lived in Wisconsin, probably no one who lives in the whole area, maybe in the entire United States, was unaware of Ed Gein.
Ed Gein was a serial killer in the 1940s and 50s whose crimes inspired the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Psycho, and the Silence of the Lambs. When police examined his home in Plainfield, Wisconsin, they found that he had collected body parts and had used them to make household items, clothing, and masks. He admitted to killing two women and was hospitalized in psychiatric institutions until his death. Errol Morris says he spent about a year investigating Ed Gein's crimes and visited him in what was then called the Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
And the superintendent of Central State Hospital was a Dr. Schubert, who I befriended. And we had a whole number of conversations about Ed Gein in the cafeteria. And I asked him at one point, is there any truth to these claims that Ed was a cannibal? And he looked at me appalled. He said, absolutely not. I talked to Ed about this very thing. And Ed assured me, although he had eaten human flesh many times, he never enjoyed it.
Oh, boy. Well, tell me, what was it like the first time you sat down with him? What did he look like? And how did he treat you? Well, how was your back and forth, the manner between the two of you?
He was very, very soft-spoken. And almost an inaudible voice. Spent a lot of time, he had a shortwave radio in his room, listening to Radio Moscow, popular in those days. And we talked about a whole number of things. I never asked him. I was possibly embarrassed. I never asked him about the details of the crimes. But we did talk about a whole number of different things.
Errol Morris didn't end up making a movie about Ed Gein, but he was thinking about it. He'd actually talked with director Werner Herzog about meeting in Wisconsin to exhume the body of Ed Gein's mother to see whether Ed Gein had stolen her corpse from a cemetery, as was alleged. But they never went through with it. We checked in with Errol Morris about this by email after our interview, and he said he, quote, ultimately declined to participate in the exhumation of the grave. Herzog ended up shooting part of a film there in Plainfield. As the story goes, Errol Morris took offense that Werner Herzog was filming in what he thought of as his landscapes. Werner Herzog gave him $2,000 as a kind of apology. The $2,000 was just enough money to fund a trip to Vernon, Florida, otherwise known as Nub City. Errol Morris says that even now, more than 40 years later, he still wants to make that movie.
There's a time, I suppose, in everyone's life where you feel very acutely the time is running out. I think I feel that way today. So many stories that I still would like to tell, so many things that I would still like to investigate. There's something about the mystery of people, the mystery of what people do or don't do, that is still unendingly compelling to me. Crime is just a way of looking at human behavior, a way of looking at ourselves, of trying to understand why we do what we do. I used to joke about, why does the chicken cross the road? Why do we tell each other this joke and this punchline to get to the other side? Why is that even funny? If it is funny, which it well might not be. To me, ultimately, it's been a question about human motivation, or chicken motivation, if you prefer. Why did the chicken cross the road? Is there a kind of deep understanding that we might have of that chicken and his desire to get to the other side? Or is there really nothing there? Is the joke that somehow we try to find an explanation where there is none? I don't know.
Criminal is created by Lauren Spohr and me. Nadia Wilson is our senior producer. Our producers are Susanna Robertson and Aaron Wade. Audio mix by Rob Byers. Special thanks to Michelle Harris. Julian Alexander makes original illustrations for each episode of Criminal. You can see them at thisiscriminal.com or on Facebook and Twitter at Criminal Show. Criminal is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. We're a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collection of the best podcasts around. Shows like Home Cooking. Home Cooking launched in March to help you figure out what to cook and keep you company during the quarantine. The show is co-hosted by chef Samin Nosrat, author of the best-selling cookbook Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and host of the Netflix series of the same name. She's joined by Hrishikesh Hirway, whom you might know as the host and producer of Song Exploder, also an upcoming Netflix series. Home Cooking has been named one of the best podcasts of 2020 by Time, Esquire, Vulture, Harper's Bazaar, and more. Go listen. I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal.
Radiotopia.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.